What does a perfect world look like to you? Welcome again to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author this quarter, and I have my conversation partners with me today, Alden Thompson and Dave Thomas, my colleagues at Walla Walla University. And we've been working our way through the book of Revelation, and we've come to the end of the book, and the good news is that the good guys win the end of the book, and everything becomes beautiful again. But I think sometimes we have a difficult time conceptualizing a utopia. What does a perfect world look like to you? Is there such a thing? Can you imagine a perfect world? What does it have? What does it not have?
No predators.
Well, to me, it would not have any brokenness. That there would be no damage to the natural world, no hostilities, no warfare, no ugliness, no
disease,
sickness, no dying. That all of that stuff would be absent, and you would live in a not overpopulated valley.
Plenty of space. Plenty of space.
For me, anyway.
You know, I love these New Testament passages here in Revelation about the new earth and the new Jerusalem. But I still think one of my favorite passages is the one of Isaiah's vegetarian kingdom in Isaiah 11. The wolf shall live with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with a kid. The calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young shall lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox.
And so you're not saying no predators, as in there aren't any animals that we love but who would prey on others. It's just that they've been transformed.
They've been transformed.
Okay.
They're friendly creatures.
I'd like to see the lion eating straw.
Yeah. I grew up with friends.
You forgot they will not hurt anywhere on my holy mountain.
Isaiah 65, yeah. I grew up with my friends, and we would talk about what we dreamed of heaven being like. And one of the things that would, I want to ride on the back of a lion and know he won't hurt me, right? And then C.S. Lewis goes and writes about it in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the kids are invited to ride on the back of Aslan. Little boys and girls' dreams are fulfilled everywhere in that story, right? Here at the
end. Where I grew up, they wanted to slide down the neck of a giraffe. I never had ambitions to do that because it's pretty knobby all the way down.
When you're from Africa, so you have a good idea what those are like. When we get to the end of chapter 18 and Babylon falls, chapter 19, the saints are rejoicing, and then there's two quick vignettes, two suppers. There's a marriage supper of the Lamb. That seems to be the good event. And then there's the final feast, what's called the Great Supper of God, and the wicked who refuse to be on God's side, Christ comes, and it says he slays them with the sword out of his mouth, which is interesting imagery. It's not typical sword warfare language. But then the wicked, the bodies of the wicked are fed to the vultures and the birds of the heavens. It's kind of a gruesome picture, but it suggests an end to battle and an end to the enemies of God. And then chapter 20, we have the vision of the millennium. Can you give me the millennium in a nutshell? Is that possible? What the 1,000 years of the reign of Christ with his saints, Satan is chained. What is the purpose?
Well, you have, I mean, there's several theories about the millennium. Some people deny its existence. They're called amillennialists. Some believe that the second coming will come prior to the millennial. They are known as premillennialists. And then there are those who believe the millennium will come prior to the second coming of Jesus, so the second coming is post-millennial. The purpose of the millennium, I think, is debated. I like the idea that this is a time, and the only clue we have, I think, is in Paul's comments to the Corinthians, where he talked about, do we not know that we will judge the saints one day? And theologians have looked at that and thought that that might be speaking about the millennium as an occasion to kind of check the book, so to speak, to see if God has acted fairly and righteously. And I like that thought a lot, because if the great controversy began with a note of suspicion, that note of suspicion has got to be eliminated somewhere. And the suspicion is removed once I'm persuaded that you have acted well or righteously and not been devious. And so if this is a time when the saints get to I thought about this, Brent, that what are you going to do if somebody, you find somebody in heaven who you didn't think should get there.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes ask students, what are you going to do if Hitler's in heaven? You're going to have a few things you want to know, right? And what if your saintly grandmother is not? You know, there's plenty of questions that are going to be floating around once the end of the controversy is over. And I like to think of the millennium as a time when those get settled before the final establishment of righteousness on the earth.
Hmm. Good thoughts. How about you, Alden? The millennium.
Well, if you take the millennium of 1,000 years, which is Revelation 20, the punchline is that all God's enemies are destroyed. And however you structure that, wherever or whenever, I think the punchline is quite clear, that all God's enemies are tossed into the lake of fire forever.
One of the challenging parts for me when I think about this 1,000 years is that when I look at the beginning of the event, there seems to be a resurrection of the righteous. That's a good event. At the end of the 1,000 years, though, there's a resurrection of the wicked. And I have wondered about that. And I've wondered, why bring them back if the cases have already been decided? And I couldn't help but wondering, what if the people who reign with Christ for 1,000 years say, God, we trust you, we believe you, but could you show us? What would happen if you gave them one more chance? What would happen if you let them come back? What would they do? And I've wondered, not that I believe there's another probationary chance for people. I get the idea that time is long past. But what if God says, let me show you what will happen?
Well, there are two clues in the book of Revelation that I think I find tantalizing. One is that God will wipe away the tears from our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean some kind of a process of resolving the tensions of the evil?
Uh-huh.
And the other one is similar, that the leaves of the nation are
leaves
of the tree of life are for the healing of the nation.
Yeah.
See, and that also suggests that there is some healing that will be taking place.
In an ongoing way, not in the moment, in a twinkling of an eye,
right. But
over time. And the healing of the nations, the word for nations there is ethne, right? The Greek word for Gentiles, but it can also mean the other nations. And I've read that with great hope. And hoping it doesn't last that long, but that's where some of the racial inequity and injustice of Earth gets solved, is around that tree of life. And I don't want it to take that long. I would like to see reconciliation for all nations and all ethnicities and all people happen here, now, today, sooner the better. But maybe it won't all get resolved. The chapter 20 brings an end to the wicked, and a final, as Alden, you've pointed out, a final lake of fire that even death and Hades are destroyed in. So it doesn't appear to be a literal lake. It definitely appears to be figurative as an end of all wickedness, evil, the enemies of God, even death. So if death is gone, then Dave, Revelation 20 suggests that one of your hopes, that there's no more death, Revelation suggests that's the case.
Yeah, and it's interesting how death and even hell are personified of sorts. I mean, they somehow they can be thrown into the lake of fire. They themselves can be destroyed.
Well, and Paul says the final enemy to be destroyed is death.
Yeah. No, I'm not debating.
Yeah,
I'm just saying is you get this picture of God or somebody taking death and saying you had enough and throw it in the lake of fire.
Well, and if you were a Greco-Roman citizen when John wrote Revelation, you knew that Hades was the god of the underworld.
Yeah.
And you knew that Thanatos was the god of death, right? So in that sense, you have these Greek words that are not just words to the Greco-Romans. They were characterized already.
Yeah.
And they represented the afterlife of those who have done evil.
Yeah.
But then chapters 21 and 22, and I'd love to spend our last few minutes here. What do these two chapters tell you about what the new heaven and the new earth will be like? What kind of hopes does it give us?
Well, the only sorrowful thing in there is it says there'll be no more sea, and I happen to like the sea. But I think it means there won't be any sea such as what we have here. I don't think it means there's no water. And the sea is a dangerous place in many ways. It's also a magnificent place. But the picture, I think, is a beautiful one. I have, over the years, liked to read that passage, especially on the new earth, at a funeral or when somebody has died, because it projects forward a hope that I think draws us forward and gives us courage. When Paul writes to the Thessalonians about not sorrowing upon the death of their loved ones, he holds out hope to them because of the final promises of God. And that's where I think Revelation intrigues me, because it's the big trajectory is very clear. It begins with people on earth who are struggling And it ends with a new heaven and a new earth where all of that has gone away.
Mm-hmm. It brings an end to the sin issue.
Yeah, so however you read Revelation, don't forget the big picture.
Yeah. I read Revelation 21 here, and I'm looking at verses 3 and 4. God says that he will be among them, he will dwell with them, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no longer any death, no more mourning or crying or pain. The former things have passed away.
Yeah, and that the gulf that has been fixed, if I can put it that way, between God and humans is now gone. Is that no longer does God have to veil himself. No longer do we have to be afraid of the physical presence of God.
And the sanctuary in the Old Testament, which was a symbol of the separation of the holy from God, is now gone.
Mm.
So the tabernacle of God is with men. God himself is there. And that's a wonderful promise.
A quick reaction. I have been reading through Revelation 21 for some time, trying to make sense of the holy city, the New Jerusalem, and its measurements that are, it's 12,000 stadia on a side, and it's suggested to be just as tall, which creates a city that, according to miles, is like 375 miles on a side.
It's a cube.
It's a cube. And I've wondered, this cube, you know, that's the scholars have suggested this is reminiscent of the most holy place in the Hebrew sanctuary in Solomon's temple, suggesting that this new Jerusalem is a most holy place all by itself. But I read language in the New Testament that suggests that we, the people of God, are like living stones being built up into a holy temple for God. Is it possible that we've made the new Jerusalem a little too literal, and maybe it's about us? Because the Apostle Paul says we are built up on a foundation of the apostles and the prophets, with Christ as the chief cornerstone.
You're going to disappoint the people who want to go to heaven because the streets are made of gold.
But isn't that maybe – that's exactly my point, though, Dave. Isn't that part of the challenge that we have, is we have been asked to give up all those things on earth, but we will be materialists in heaven?
And what will be the value of gold if it's used for paving? It's like being glad you have a piece of asphalt.
Yeah, right.
I like very much Paul, I think, is the one who said that eye has not seen nor ear heard, nor has they entered into the thoughts of man what God has in store for us. And when I think about that, I like the language in Revelation, but I don't think it really holds a candle to the reality that we're going to experience.
Yeah. John's language is very limited. We're just about out of time. One last comment. Can you summarize your experience with the book of Revelation this quarter, or something that struck you from the book?
I'm always very glad to get to the end of the book, Brent, if you pardon me saying that.
Why is that?
Oh, no, because I find the book itself kind of convoluted and difficult.
But the end is good news.
Yeah, the end is good. And the constancy of God is good news.
Yeah, yeah. How about for you, Alden? Final words.
Well, if I put positive spin on it, the book of Revelation, bottom line is God wins. But there's certainly a lot of fire and mayhem along the way.
And just maybe that's what the book is supposed to be telling us. Thank you all for listening in this quarter, our study of the book of Revelation. Thank you to Alden Thompson and Dave Thomas, my colleagues and conversation partners. And throughout the quarter, thank you to Jared Miller, our sound engineer. For The Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.